You're listening to AsiaPac Unwrapped, first broadcast on the 26th of July 2015 on Monocle 24. AsiaPac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ. Hello and welcome to the 13th edition of AsiaPac Unwrapped, in association with ANZ on Monocle 24. Produced from our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and right here at Midori House in London, this is your unmissable weekly briefing from the world's most dynamic region. Coming up in the program, Japanese car maker Suzuki is taking on the higher end of the market across India.
This is a brand that's known for making cheap, reliable cars. It has a huge, extensive, established sales network. And a lot of Indians end up getting a Maruti Suzuki as their first car.
And despite claims of an accommodation shortage, Melbourne looks set to lose one of its most historically significant five-star hotels. Also ahead, we'll look at how foreign investment is spawning a new love for rather tiny bars in Phnom Penh.
They're pretty small and they're all very, very different. One of them, for instance, is a gin bar and fits, I don't know, maximum 20 people. And there you can get gin with hand-infused flavors such as chili or lemongrass or fruits.
And later in the show, we'll touch down for 24 hours in Bangkok. That's all to come on AsiaPac Unwrapped in association with ANZ, starting now. I'm Ben Ryland, and this is AsiaPac Unwrapped, the show where we take a closer look at the world's most dynamic region. Starting us off today, we're heading to India, where rising interest in the higher end of the automotive market is attracting international attention. While Suzuki has operated in the region for some time now, the company is set to unveil a new brand aimed at the luxury consumer. Well, joining me now from Monocle's Tokyo Bureau is our Asia Editor-at-Large, Kenji Hall. Kenji, do you want to just start us off by giving us a bit of background on Suzuki in Japan and how that expanded into India back in the 1980s?
If we look at Suzuki's image in Japan, it's that of a small car maker. It's nowhere near as big as the big three, Toyota, Nissan, and Honda, in terms of market share. At the same time, if you look in India, Suzuki's brand image is entirely different. It's known by the venture that it's involved in as Maruti Suzuki. They've worked together since the early 1980s. Maruti was one of the pioneering car makers that got its start well before the 70s. They now have 47% market share in India. This is a brand that's known for making cheap, reliable cars. It has a huge, extensive, established sales network. And a lot of Indians end up getting a Maruti Suzuki as their first car. So there was a time when Indians aspired to owning a car, a low-cost, fuel-efficient car. The problem is that nowadays, families in India's rising class in particular own more than one car, and when they do buy a second car, they tend to upgrade to a foreign brand. Often that's a Japanese brand, but instead of going for a Suzuki or a Maruti Suzuki, they would go for a Honda, a Nissan, or a Toyota. So Maruti Suzuki's strategy is for Suzuki, the Japanese car brand, to sell some of its cars simply badged as Suzuki and not as Maruti Suzuki. Maruti Suzuki will still exist as a brand. It's just it'll be the lower-end cars. The higher-end cars like an SUV and a premium sedan or saloon, as it's known in the UK, like the Kizashi, and a few compact models loaded with extras will be branded Suzuki.
What market factors do you think might have pushed Suzuki to open this new brand name in India? And do you think that this is representing a more of a wider trend upon other manufacturers to expand into that region?
Well, I think the fact that India is one of the world's fastest growing car markets is a huge factor in the decision here. Also, in the past, Maruti Suzuki had tried to market Suzuki's as Maruti Suzuki's and had failed through its existing sales network. And so this really is a chance to rebrand, really, the cars that they've been selling all along. We've seen this in other markets, Toyota with its Lexus brand, Nissan with its Infiniti brand. You know, it is an effective marketing strategy. It has helped those car makers reach the luxury end of the market. And so, you know, for Suzuki to do this, I think is a natural thing. as I mentioned before, it's just a very aggressive attempt to go after the rising middle class in India, where people can afford, you know, higher-end premium cars. Obviously, Maruti Suzuki will want to do this because that premium sector is where profit margins are higher. It's also, in terms of prestige for the brand, it's a good thing. Just wanted to note that Suzuki cars will be sold through special dealerships where sales executives will be handpicked and trained in the hospitality ways of five-star hotels. How Suzuki will do ultimately in the long run remains unclear, but you know, at least this is a good start. It's a sound strategy, I think.
That was Kenji Hall there at our Tokyo Bureau. You're listening to Asia-Pac Unwrapped. Up next, we'll look at the uncertainty surrounding Melbourne's much-loved Windsor Hotel. This is Asia-Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Well, there's no debating that Melbourne's Windsor Hotel is one of Australia's most beautiful and historically significant buildings. But the issue of what to do with the much-loved but crumbling structure is becoming a political thorn. The hotel's owner, Adi Halim, is petitioning the Victorian government for the right to refurbish the 19th century landmark on the corner of Burke and Spring Streets, opposite the State Parliament, restoring it to its former glory. The plan would add a 27-storey glass curtain tower set slightly back from the original street-level building, plus a contemporary zinc box extension on the site of a pre-existing 1960s addition. Now, he argues that it's possible to be both culturally sensitive to the heritage-listed building and forward-thinking, ensuring the five-star hotel remains a key player in the tourism sector for years to come. Monocle's contributor Stephen A. Russell spoke to Adi Halim to find out more.
We started getting involved with the Windsor back in 2005, so it's about 10 years now. So when we purchased the hotel, we look at it as a long-term investment. And then we look at what we need to do with the hotel, because the hotel hasn't been refurbished for many decades. And many owners previously have attempted to come up with a solution that could bring the Windsor back to where it was a long time ago. And the hotels has changed hands many times throughout. So when we look at that, what we can do with the hotels, obviously, it was built as a hotel. It was built during the gold rush. There was a glorious time in Melbourne. It has been a hotel for the last 132 years. And we believe that the best use for the precinct is to keep it as a hotel. So that's the objective. And then we look at what is required to financially able to put the project together. And then we look at who is the right person to do that, to work with us. And we always understand that the hotel sits in a very important part of Melbourne with Parliament House and the old Treasury building just across the road. So we look for the right architects to deliver that job. And finally, we came to the conclusion the right people are Denton Cocker Marshall, who's known for their works all across Melbourne. In the UK, they just recently completed the Stonehenge Visitor Centre. So the way Denton Cocker Marshall approached the project is looking at it from the overall context of the precinct. Obviously, we have a beautiful 19th century Victorian architecture, and then we have a 1960s wing that's abutting it for a long time. So it looks like it's stuck to one side of it. So Denton Cocker Marshall's solution to that is to replace the 1960s building with a new contemporary architecture that's literally a sculptural form of a zinc cube with random punch windows through it, which is a reflection of the solid and void relationship in the 19th century building.
And I guess we've got history in Melbourne. I mean, you look at something like Federation Square.
Absolutely.
That's, you know, that has done this next to you know, Heritage Cathedral, and quite
Absolutely.
Successfully.
Opposite the cathedral and opposite the Flinders Street Station, both are very important heritage building. And the strategy is, instead of putting a buildings on the precinct, we're actually creating sculptural objects next to and behind the Windsor, behind the 19th century building. So that's one strategy on the northern annex of the Windsor. And that zinc cube is elevated above ground to give it a bit of lightness and open up the intersection of Spring Street and Burke Street. And then comes to the point where they need to find more volumes for the hotel to make it financially viable. Because of the sensitivity of the precinct, then Denton Cocker Marshall created this big giant glass curtain, literally curved glass curtain that seems to float behind the Windsor. And this tower is set back 25 meters from both Spring Street and Bourke Street. That's probably the biggest setback from any street frontage I've ever seen in any Melbourne CBD projects. And the idea, again, it is an object that floats behind the Windsor, elegantly provides a backdrop to the 19th century building against all the random city skyline behind it. And with the Denton commercial style, I'm sure, you know, the detailing will be fantastic. It will look literally, as you can see the renderings here, it will look exactly what they intend to do. And the approach sometimes can be quite old school, but the results are very contemporary and timeless.
That was Stephen A. Russell there in conversation with Adi Halim at Melbourne's Windsor Hotel. Still to come, we'll look at why China might be a ripe market for art education, and we'll spend 24 hours in Bangkok.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Though it's had a troubled history, tourism to Cambodia has become a staple of the country's economy. With its beautiful array of temples and ruins of lost civilizations, not to mention the country's natural beauty, it's easy to see why the country continues to attract the curious traveler. In recent years, however, the country's capital has been garnering a different reputation. Increasing economic growth in Phnom Penh is igniting a boom in new developments, with hotels, restaurants, and residential complexes popping up throughout the city. But the renewed interest is also making an impact in a somewhat smaller way. Robert Carmichael has been living in Phnom Penh for nearly 10 years, and as he explains, when it comes to trendy bar hopping in Phnom Penh, small is often best.
By the standards of capital cities, Phnom Penh is quite small. It's about 2 million people, and it's still largely a low-rise capital. The other thing about Phnom Penh is that it's got a lot of places where people can go and eat and drink. And for a lot of Cambodians, that means, you know, roadside street vendors, little places on the pavement with plastic chairs, that kind of thing. It's quite affordable. And if they want to drink, which is largely a male pursuit here, then they go to beer gardens. But Cambodia is a tropical country, so for a lot of people who can afford to get indoors and get away from the heat, they're going to prefer to go to indoors restaurants. And among those, I'd include expatriates and, of course, wealthier Cambodians and, you know, young aspirational Cambodians. And a lot of those restaurants and bars are pretty similar to what you'll find anywhere else in the world. Microbars, they started popping up in about 2012, and all of them are sort of the brainchilds of two Kiwi brothers who turned up here some years back. And they'd been here a couple of years, and they decided to try something different to the typical bars that you have here. And these micro bars were the culmination of that. And it's a little mini empire they've built up over a couple of years since then. The micro bars they've set up, they've got them in really two places, one more dominant than the other. There's a little alleyway near one of the focal points of central Phnom Penh called the Independence Monument. And the little alleyway, which is quite hidden, surprisingly, for such a central spot, is called Basak Lane. And down that lane, they've got more than half a dozen of these micro bars. And when I say micro, I mean they are really quite small. The smallest one is only 3 meters by 4 meters. The largest is about 10 by 6 meters. So they're pretty small, and they're all very, very different. One of them, for instance, is a gin bar, and probably fits, I don't know, maximum 20 people. And there you can get gin with hand-infused flavors such as chili or lemongrass or fruits. You can pop next door to another one of their bars, because these bars are down an alleyway. I mean, it's 30 meters long, and they must have half a dozen bars on this little strip. So you can pop next door if you get bored of the gin drinks and go to another bar, which is completely different context, completely different fit out, completely different look. And essentially what they've managed to build up is this sort of cool contemporary place in this little alleyway that before didn't have a lot going for it and now has these sort of funky, vibrant little bars going on there with a really different array of themes and of drinks and of food and offerings and stuff. And it's become really a place for those in the know in Phnom Penh to hang out. Not a lot of tourists know about it, not a lot of tourists go there, but quite a lot of expats and quite a few Cambodians too go and hang out in this Basak Lane area. There's no question that international investment has had a big impact on Cambodia. And with tourism being such a key part of the economy here, a lot of money has gone into that. I mean, these guys are very much, you know, young, entrepreneurial. They're only now in their early to mid 30s. So these are young guys who haven't come here necessarily with a lot of money, but they've come here with a good idea. And in so doing, they've created something unique and they've created jobs for young Cambodians. And of course, you know, in Cambodia, there are very few job opportunities for people. So, yeah, I would say rather than this being the result of an inward investment, I think it's more the result of somebody being here, seeing the market and the opportunity, and then taking a chance on that and seeing where it goes. And certainly, you know, it's done well for them in Phnom Penh. They've got 9 or 10 of these micro bars now. And I guess at some point they'll look to perhaps push them up to Siem Reap, which is in the northwest of Cambodia. And that's the real tourist draw there, is where the temples of Angkor Wat and all the other temples are that people who come to Cambodia without fail go and visit. So I would imagine they've got ideas to get up there at some point.
That was Robert Carmichael there in the Cambodian capital, Phnom Penh. In a few moments here on Asia Pac Unwrapped, we'll touch down in Bangkok to see what the city has to offer in just 24 hours. For now, though, we're talking art. Chinese appetites for art collecting are on the rise. Works by Chinese contemporary artists such as Zheng Fanzi are highly prized around the world, which is also sparking a wider interest in the field. Tapping into that rising trend, two of the world's leading auction houses, Sotheby's and Christie's, are expanding their tertiary-level art business courses in conjunction with Chinese universities. In a moment, we'll hear from Sotheby's about their program in collaboration with Beijing's prestigious Tsinghua University. First, though, Monocle's Kurt Lin from our Hong Kong bureau sits down with Sophie Hu, program manager at Christie's Education in Asia.
There's a shift from theoretical art education to pragmatic art education. So we can see that no matter in art schools in mainland or in Hong Kong, they currently tend to open more classes like curation and art business rather than focusing only on art history as previous years. And secondly, there is a rise of art investment EMBA program. So currently in mainland China and also in Singapore and Japan, but I would say most obviously in mainland China, the top business schools are opening particularly art investment program, and they're eager to collaborate with auction houses like Christie's. And the third is the rise of Chinese collectors' interests beyond Chinese art. So previously, based on our data, Chinese collectors buy local. So they buy antiques and they buy Chinese paintings. But currently we can see that there is lots of, you know, Chinese very rich entrepreneur. They start to buy Picasso, they start to buy Van Gogh, even Francois Picquin. So these shed some lights on, you know, designing courses. So we currently try to design more courses like impressionism and abstractionism, particularly for mainland Chinese entrepreneurs. And the fourth, I would say, is a rise of the general interest from the public towards art. So previously, people would think, oh, there is an art gallery and it looks so fancy, I'm not there to walk in. Or people would think art is something that, you know, very intelligent people or very rich people would be interested in. But now actually, it's different. With lots of, you know, art spaces opening and art programs opening to the public, so general public, even, you know, secondary school students, like high school students, or, you know, very general public, like walking on the street, they just show their interest towards arts. And finally, I would say, you know, because Currently, there are lots of exhibitions going on, and with the rise of public museum like M+, supported by the government in Hong Kong, and private museums spring in mainland China, people have this interest in the topic of museums, display, and curation.
Kurt Lin there from Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau in conversation with Sophie Hu. And of course, as we mentioned, Sotheby's is also catering to the growing demand for art education in Asia. I popped into the rather lovely Sotheby's Cafe on New Bond Street here in London for a chat with Cindy Mack, Public Programs Manager at Sotheby's Institute of Art.
Sotheby's Institute of Art is the education arm of the auction house. So starting from 1969, we have been providing professional training, in particular art business and different areas of art education to students as well as professionals. We have six master's degrees program currently offered in London, and we also have schools in Los Angeles and New York. Apart from the MA programs, we offer continuing education, short courses, summer studies, semester studies, and different public programs for people who are interested in learning more about art. We now have a new collaboration in China with Tsinghua University. Our first executive program was actually launched last year, and it was completed successfully in early July. So this program is particularly popular among collectors from Asia, because we will take them around the world to different art cities and to learn how to build, expand, and manage their own private collections. So throughout the studies, they will be able to learn from our faculty about legal issues, auction operations, gallery and the industry relationships, as well as how to source artworks from different channels such as art fairs, auction houses, galleries, art districts, etc. Currently, there are only a handful institutions that can offer this kind of education, art education, to students and collectors in China. And in fact, reported in TIFOF in March, there are actually more than 300,000 art organizations and businesses globally, with over 2.5 million jobs worldwide. But with a lack of art education providers, a lot of art professionals and students are coming to Sotheby's Institute to receive the professional training so that they can be part of the global workforce. And by joining a force with Tsinghua University, not only we are able to nurture next generation of collectors and students, we can also give them the international exposure that they don't receive in the region.
That was my conversation with Cindy Mack at the Sotheby's Cafe on New Bond Street here in London. And I challenge anyone to venture through that area of this city without feeling the enormous temptation to enjoy a spot of shopping. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Up next, we're in Bangkok. Now let's assume for a moment that you've found yourself in Bangkok for a 24-hour layover. Layovers can be annoying, and airports can be wonderful places, but why not use that time to see what the city has to offer? Where would you go and what would you want to see? Well, we put those questions to Monocle contributor Tony Cheng, who runs us through his city now.
If I've got just 24 hours in Bangkok, I don't want to waste valuable time stuck in the city's infamous traffic jams. From the international airport, take the express train into Makassan Station. It's not as fast or efficient as Hong Kong's Airport Express, but it will beat the traffic. This is a city that's fast, furious, and a bit rough around the edges, so it pays to indulge yourself once in a while, and where better to start than at the spa. Thailand is the spiritual home of the spa, from homeopathic massage to street-side foot rubs, and much more besides. My personal favourite is The King and I on Sukhumvit Soi 12. Unlike the film of the same name, which remains banned in Thailand, this Korean joint remains a firm favourite of locals and expats. If you're looking for something a bit more Thai, try Ruan Nad on Soi Convent. After a good steam, you can cool off in the ice room and the freezing dip pool, which should set you up for the melting temperatures back out on the streets. Eating is a national pastime in Thailand. Slim and dainty Thais belie their outward appearance with a seemingly insatiable appetite. And snacking is a full-time occupation. There are some exceptional restaurants showing off the finest royal Thai cuisine and more modern interpretations at David Thompson's Nam and the SES Siamese Club. But I don't think you can beat the street food. The stalls on Soi 38 at Tong Lor Skytrain Station offer a fantastic range of dishes, from Thai-style chicken rice to the eponymous pad Thai noodles. The mango and sticky rice here is the best in Thailand. Even further afield, but worth the trek, is Ortogor Wet Market, opposite Chatuchak Weekend Market in Mo Chit. A huge range of fresh ingredients and cooked food is available. I like the shrimp brain curry, to eat there or to take away. The other national pastime is shopping. Bangkok's home to some of the region's biggest and most luxurious malls, drawing shoppers from all over Asia. Siam Paragon and Central World are now facing new challenges for the crown of most opulent shopping center from recently opened Central Embassy and M Courtier. My tastes, however, are a bit more down market and more eclectic. And if you can stand the crowds, MBK or Marbun Krong is a lot of fun. Lots of small electronic stores and phone accessories with cheap fashion and fun souvenirs. Jose Mourinho was snapped doing his shopping here during the recent Chelsea tour of Thailand. This is a city not short of sights, but the tourists attract a lot of scammers, and I prefer the road less travelled. Check out the Nancy Chandler map for some ideas, but I recommend the Jim Thompson House, conveniently close to MBK. This traditional Thai wooden house, built by the man who restored the reputation of the Thai silk industry, is a beautiful oasis of historical and rural charm in this bustling city. Jim Thompson himself disappeared in mysterious circumstances in Malaysia, but he left a legacy in Thailand that's honored in this quiet museum. And after that little interlude, it's time to eat again. My favorite evening eatery is Jay Liap on Pahonyutin Road, next to Pia Thai Hospital. Don't try to find it during the day, there's nothing there. But at 6 p.m. the tables spill out onto the street, serving some of the best seafood in a city that takes that claim very seriously. Try the crab curry and the scallops grilled in butter in their own shells. They don't speak much English, but lots of smiling and pointing will reward you with a delicious meal. Bangkok nightlife is as famous as it is infamous. But one of my favorite things to do is walk around the old flower market down by the river after 11 p.m. Bales of orchids in all the colors of the rainbow, exotic blooms from the darkest corners of the jungle, and sacks of jasmine that scent the steamy night air. As the traders jostle and barter, it's a fitting way to finish the day in a city that rarely sleeps. For Monocle in Bangkok, I'm Tony Chen.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of Asia Pac Unwrapped in association with ANZ. The show was produced by our studios in Tokyo, Hong Kong and Singapore, and by me, Ben Rylan, here at Midori House in London. Nina Norick was our editor and Kurt Lin was our researcher. Asia Pac Unwrapped is back at the same time next week. That's 7 a.m. Monday in Sydney, 9 a.m. in Wellington and 2200 hours on Sunday here in London. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or tune in via iTunes or SoundCloud, or of course the handy little Monocle app. This is Asia Pac Unwrapped on Monocle 24 in association with ANZ. Until next time, I'm Ben Rylan. Enjoy your week.